Hey guys, welcome back to Not My Type. This is the podcast where we talk about the Enneagram through a scientific lens. And today I am here with my friends Jessica and Malia. For context, I am a sexual social 2 and 3 with 7 and 8 fixes. Why don't you guys say hi?
Hi, I'm Jessica. I am a self-bisexual 6 wing 7 with 9 and 4 fixes.
Hi, I am Malia. I'm a social self-pres 7 wing 6 with 2 and 8 fixes.
And today we are jumping into a topic that we sort of came up with about a year-ish ago, but we fleshed out and uncovered some more exciting nuances to how it functions. So we're talking about the instinctual variants. If you're not familiar, this is the self-preservation, social, and sexual instincts. You can go to our website to figure out a little bit more about the basics behind them.
Which is
notmytypeenneagram.com. Thank you for the helpful tip. But basically, we're going to talk about those instincts and the way they interact in a specific order, which are called the instinctual stackings. There are 6 of them. So if you don't know about the instincts, we have some podcasts about that. But you can also check out our website and read more about how they function in a basic sort of average sense. But today, we're talking about something that is a little bit more advanced as far as instincts goes. We are going to discuss something that we are calling the instinctual cycle, which is basically the way that instincts are interconnected to each other, not just in humans, but in the world at large.
So I know that you referenced back to an old episode, but say someone is just now listening. Can you just really briefly talk about what are the instincts?
Super briefly, there are 3 different animalistic drives within us that make us protect ourselves and survive long term. So the self-preservation instinct is basically our drive that draws attention to the physical world and our physical needs. It makes sure that we are sufficiently well-rested and well-fed and able-bodied and safe and comfortable. Think about like all the most sort of basic, tangible sense of where you are in the world and how comfortable you feel in your environment physically. That's what the self-preservation instinct provides for us. So someone who is dominant in that instinct is going to be overly attentive to their physical needs and their physical world. And that's most people. Most people are self-preservation dominant types. The social instinct is the 2nd most common instinct. So for context, Jessica is a self-preservation type and Malia is a social type. So each of the 3 of us fill these instincts as our dominant. So as a social type, Malia is preoccupied with relationship and connection and status and role and who falls where, who has authority here, who doesn't. Who is influencing other people, and is that because of a specific category they fall into? Mm. So the social instinct draws our attention to sort of the more abstract, like boxes we put people into in a basic sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm like thinking a lot about people and how they relate to me and how I relate to them and how they relate to each other. I'm just thinking a lot about people.
So since these instincts are so animalistic, if you think about the self-preservation instinct as like the animal's need for food or shelter or like basically a cave to dwell in, the social instinct is the animal's need for a herd, basically for a tribe or a community that helps supply food, you know, or helps supply comfort or helps provide co-regulation. I was thinking about this the other day about how like the human need to like cuddle or touch each other is actually a very social instinct thing most of the time because it's just it's a desire to feel another person that cares about you and you care about. And that sort of general co-regulatory care is really what the social instinct is about. And so because of that, people who are social dominant are overly attentive to really how are we influencing each other? How do I influence you and how do you influence me? And do we like each other? Do we not? Do we share similar values or do we not? Do we come from similar backgrounds or do we not? So social is really all the ways we unconsciously label and categorize ourselves and each other. And thus, it affects our sense of location and how we interact. And then the sexual instinct, which is my dominant instinct, is it's fulfilling a very different human need, an animalistic need, and it's very disruptive. And thus, it's the least common instinct because it basically rips things up. It's the psyche's need to find newness and transformation and basically to change. It's not just change broadly in the sense of like develop and grow, but basically to have your world like transformed. So if you can sort of think about it elementally, I think everyone has this general life that's comfortable and functional, but eventually there's this impulse of like, what if I just changed everything? Mm. You know, that sort of need within us to like have things get suddenly violent. You know, it's
some people are sitting at home listening to this, shaking their head and being like, no, I do not.
Right. And that's because most people are blind to the sexual instinct. So the need to sort of be transformed and open yourself to things, not just like open yourself to like, oh, I want to learn about this new thing, but in general, sort of open yourself to being changed by it. That's the sexual instinct. And so it propels us to sort of magnetically open ourselves to other people or things or concepts or ideas that arouse us. And so the sexual instinct draws us into sort of a cyclical attraction scheme where we advertise, this is what makes me unique and distinct, in the need to provoke a chemical interaction as opposed to sort of a social relational interaction. Does that, I'm getting sort of vague, so yeah, I feel like so, people should redirect
me. Specifically to the loss of self.
Right.
So that you can merge with this other.
Right, and that's really what it about is. It's about, if we look at the social instinct, social wants to find shared common ground. It wants to find, what do we connect on? What do we already value? And how do we relate to each other because of that? The sexual instinct is functioning based on polarity. So it's unconsciously attracted to, what are the things that are very opposite from me?
Yeah.
But it's not, of course, it's not a very conscious thought process. It's an instinctual attraction.
It's the classic, like, opposites attract, you know, the good girl likes the bad boy kind of trope, if you will.
Right. So then take that idea and map it onto everything. And so the sexual type is unconsciously becoming a magnetic polarizing force in its environment. So sexual types are very provocative in their environment because they are unconsciously trying to differentiate themselves as a means of disrupting what's happening in their environment. Do you have more to say about that?
No, I would just add that, like, you're putting out there, therefore, your own kind of, I don't know if, like, flavor or just kind of, like, thing that you know that is going to, that some people are going to, like, love and need more of and, like, be, like, it's going to be, like, a drug, and others are just going to be, like, no, that's not for me. But you're doing that specifically to get the people who are going to use you as a drug and who you want to use them as a drug. So it's, like, a constant, like, just taking and being taken.
That's very social blind language, but yes. It's a little, it's crude, but it makes sense. It's, there's a sort of, the sexual instinct is like a peacock flaring its feathers. It's him saying to his desired partner, this is what is so beautiful and shiny and colorful about me, and thus you should be addicted to me. Which he does, and he might attract a mate, but in the process, he'll make enemies. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like his, the other men, the other male peacocks are going to be offended and affronted because now you're competition.
I don't know if this is like accurate, so you can correct me, but is it kind of like, you know, I think of the social and the self-pres as instincts when they're primary as being very normal, mundane. But, like, I feel like we see a lot of sexual primary instinct people in, like, media, like the Kardashians or James Charles or, like, H&R, whatever that thing is,
I
collection.
Hear what you're saying, but no.
Yeah, most of those people are sexually blind.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of them are, but in the celebrity world, you'll notice there are people who have gotten famous for being sexual types. So, for example, like, Lady Gaga is a sexual type who got famous for being a sexual type, basically. Uh-huh.
Or David Bowie, who is walking sexual DOMs, this is important too, walk the line between male and female, so there is an androgynous quality to all of them.
Right, because the polarity of self is held in the sexual instinct. So most people are blind to the sexual instinct and thus have a fairly conventional sexual display. So people, women who are sexual blind will more often have sort of feminine sexual attitudes, and thus men who are sexual blind will more often have masculine sexual attitudes. Of course, that's a broad generalization, so it doesn't apply in every context, but sexual types are advertising what makes them distinct, which is often sort of both a masculine, I'm going to take and destroy and hunt energy, but also at the same time, the feminine, I'm ready to be taken and destroyed and hunted. So the sexual instinct is both the hunter and the prey.
Yeah, predator and prey.
It's very abstract language because the sexual instinct is attracted to sort of an abstract magnetic chemical yearning. Anyways, I've gone too far on this, but...
Well, I have a question, I guess, around that, because when I'm hearing you talk about all of these different instincts, and from what I understand, what we're talking about today is kind of how the instincts can be stacked in different orders. My first thought as like a commonplace person is that it reminds me of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which comes in a very distinct order. It's shelter and self-preservation first, and then it goes community need, social need, and then at the very top you have
self-actualization.
Like, yeah. And but what you're saying is that not everyone operates in that order.
Right, but I do think that there's a reason that Maslow's hierarchy of needs starts with physical needs and then goes to relational needs and then goes to self-actualization. I think it mimics the sort of implicit, most common pattern for humanity, which
right.
is that most people, their most basic need is to be physically comfortable and able-bodied,
right.
and then to have relationship, and then And then lastly, to sort of fulfill or sort of be itself. That's, we're getting very abstract and sort of...
I would disagree, though. I think that the social of being connected of a herd and, like, taking care of other people is the most evolutionized, like, the most highest that you can get. I feel like that, like, animals can do these, I take care of my own needs, I mate, I peacock, but the social, like, animals, I feel like are, like, at a level above.
Right, so Maslow's needs don't necessarily map specifically mm-hmm. here, but the concepts are sort of all laced throughout. Right.
Yeah.
What we're talking today is not about which of these instincts are, like, most common to have in a specific order or not. We'll talk about that a little bit, but mostly we're here to discuss what we found to be sort of a universal blueprint in how they represent archetypal stages of life and death in all things, not just in humans, but in the process of a tree, for example. So you can take a general... idea of the fact that something has a start, and then it has a development, and then it has a turnaround toward death, and then it has a gradual decrease and sort of shrinking and dying process, and then it restarts. There's a lot we could say about that. Jess, do you want to start?
Yeah, not only trees, how stars form and die, how the moon goes through its cycles, how seeds of every kind, it's like all over.
Mm. Right.
It's really fun.
And I want to talk about, so David Gray is an Enneagram theorist who really did a lot with Enneagram instinct concepts. He provided a really rich, fascinating model for how they function. David created this concept of three of the instinctual stackings that were synflow, which means they sort of had a natural participatory perspective. And three of the stackings were what he called contraflow, meaning they were sort of non-participatory and opposed to each other. So his model proposed that three of the stackings moved one direction, like counterclockwise, and the other three moved clockwise.
And mm-hmm. remind us what a stacking is.
Right. So an instinctual stacking is sort of the specific order that it falls within a person. So the most common instinctual stacking is self-preservation first and social second, and then sexual at the bottom. So we would abbreviate that as self-presocial, omitting the blind spot or the blind instinct. So the idea of a stacking... suggests that there's a primary instinct that is our most carnal, most everyday need that we think about all the time without even realizing it. And then we have a secondary instinct that sort of supports that dominant instinct where we are also thinking about it, but we're viewing it at an arm's length. We're not terribly obsessed with it. And then we have a blind instinct that is concealed between the first, like, but behind the first two needs. And so we don't think about it much, and we often are at odds with the idea of prioritizing its needs.
Yeah, it's both not nuanced and overconfident in its knowledge of.
Right. We don't
oh,
really
interesting.
we don't have a level or balanced perspective of our blind instinct because we're really not doing it in a regular sense. I saw a great example of this the other day. Like I'm blind to the self-preservation instinct, for example. And I suddenly had Jessica loves to tell the story, so I should let her tell it. But I was suddenly coming in contact with more ritual habits and ways of taking care of my body and my health, which are sort of self-preservation topics. But I don't remember what I said to you specifically, but you should.
Well, and then you were calling me and you were like, well, I'm lying on a trampoline right now and I'm sunning myself so I can like build
base layer.
Like self-preservation strength, because like self-preservation is like what drives
this like forbearance of like, I'm so uncomfortable right now. And I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. Are you using sunscreen? And he was like, no. And I was like, so you're burning your body. He's like, yeah, I'm practicing self-preservation. I was like, honey, that's not self-preservation.
right. So like the self-preservation instinct drives us to sort of like push ourselves and like make sure that we have physical skills and that we can sort of strengthen or like handle toughness. And I didn't realize, like, in the process of trying to like I was trying to like grow self-pres, you know what I'm saying? I'm like putting myself in the sun, like I'm getting vitamin D, blah blah blah,
burning yourself.
Right. I'm trying to like build some forbearance.
You're sexually lighting yourself on fire with the sun.
Right. It's an unconscious like beautifying of self, but I'm labeling it in my brain as like, oh, I'm building forbearance, but I'm literally burning myself, you know what I'm saying? Like my blindness to self-preservation, I didn't even consider putting on self, like on sunscreen.
Right. So at the same time as you were attempting to do self-preservation, you were actually failing at it.
Right, because we unconsciously think that our blind instinct is a very simple concept. We don't mean to do it.
Right.
But when we try to like broach the topic of it, it's like very sort of clunky. We handle it in a way that is not nuanced, as opposed to people who are dominant in it,
right,
have a very like textured daily understanding, whether or not they know it, of that instinct.
That's a really interesting way to look at it, actually. And now I'm curious, Jess, do you have an example of when you were attempting to use your social instinct?
when the story that you always like to tell was when I was taking that interview of someone.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, so what's the, you know, we ask, one of the questions was like, what's the best time of your life and what's the worst time of your life? And so I asked, like, what's the worst time of your life? And this woman goes into this really sad story about, like, her dad dying and, like, stuff like that. And then she finishes and I'm like, okay. So, if you had to be an animal, what animal would you be?
No!
She moves right past it, and I'm like, Jessica, no.
No. Which is totally not you being uncaring. It's just you being blind to, like, what's socially appropriate
right.
for yeah, you in that I moment. Was in an,
like, for me, I was doing the social thing, because I was now in an interview setting, and an interview is a certain kind of social thing. No. So I was just going to, like, go through questions, because that's what you do in an interview style. You don't stop and interrupt the video, and are right. like, oh, I'm so sorry. Just keep going.
Right.
And so I kept going. And then after that, Jack was like, Jessica, we need to talk.
Right.
No.
So you don't, like, insult all of our interviewees.
Right.
And she's not trying to do that. It's just that social provides us an eye to sort of, like, the hidden rule book
yeah.
of, like, how we're supposed to interact. And so having social first or second doesn't mean that you necessarily obey it. But it means that you're aware of what's the hidden code here. And what am I being expected to do? And am I going to do it or not?
Yeah.
And someone who's social blind isn't reading those things. So there's not really a sharp awareness of, like, oh, this person wants me to do this.
Mm. Yeah, I have my own rule book. I feel like there's a universal rule book that I just am not privy to that I'm trying to learn.
And I think that I'm sensing that that's true of all of the dominant instincts, that they almost come with this, whatever instinct you're born dominant with, comes with this intrinsic rule book that you know and everyone knows. But if you don't have that as your dominant instinct, it's like you don't know.
You don't actually know.
And it's yeah. really hard to learn that because it's so unspoken.
And it looks like you're rebelling against it, or like, you know, like for Jack, I'm like, oh, of course he knows about sunscreen. He actually doesn't know. And so, like, it looks like he's being, like, rebellious against it, and he's actually not. It's just that you don't even know what you don't know.
Well, like, right. I would like to say I do know what sunscreen is. But it's not occurring to me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm
right.
thinking about, like, I'm going to go outside. I'm going to take my shirt off and, like, expose my skin and get some vitamin D. Like, I'm thinking about this, like, beautifying and strengthening of self. But, like, even in that moment where I'm trying to, like, quote-unquote, do self-prez.
You're doing it in a very sexual
way.
Way.
Right. It's like I'm beautifying myself. Like,
right.
The sexual instinct needs to be... It needs to be an addictive drug, really. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, how do I enrich or cultivate this, like... hyper-specific look or pheromonal scent that is very much me. You know what I'm saying? And so even in that moment, like, I'm not thinking about it, but I'm trying to, like, sharpen the beauty of me.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm labeling it in my brain as, like, oh, I'm preserving self.
Right.
Which is not really what's happening.
Right, right.
Anywho, I feel like we should move on to this, like, instinctual cycle that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Because I want to talk about... Back to David Gray. He talked about this concept of a... contraflow or sin flow stacking. And his ideas were really good in the sense that, like, he noticed that some of the stackings, the sin flow stackings, were very participatory. They were sort of dealing with life and dealing with other people and with the world in a sense of, like, I'm part of what's happening.
Mm.
Versus the contraflow stackings, he noticed, were viewing the world from this very sort of distant or non-participatory lens. So just for context, David labeled sexual self-prez, self-prez social, and social sexual as the sin flow stackings. So those were the three stackings that were very much, like, in their own experience. And then he labeled sexual social, social self-prez, and self-prez sexual as the contra flow stackings.
Mm.
But what I really could not get over is that he noticed this difference in the way they viewed the world, but didn't have any explanation for why the contraflow stackings were, like, so out of body. You know what I'm saying? They were distanced from their own experience. So, for example, Jessica, Malia, and I, all three of us actually share the three quote-unquote contraflow stackings. And I've noticed this in the way we do podcasts and just do life when we talk with each other. There's a sort of zooming out from our own experience. I feel like Jessica notices this all the time, where we are living something. And then in the very moment that we're living it, we zoom out and we're, like, watching ourselves living it. And so Malia, on the drive here, literally tonight we were driving here, and Malia and I were on the phone, and she was like, do you ever, like, have a moment where you're watching yourself do something and then you realize that you're watching yourself doing that thing?
Uh-huh.
And I was sort of pointing out that, like, that's the top-down perspective of the three stackings we have. Which
she also, when she got here, she was like, yeah, I was thinking about our conversation, and, like, it was from a very, like, analytical, like, and, like, conversations in general, and how, like, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's right. super interesting, because your social self-pres, so the social self-pres is their, like, separateness comes out way stronger than the other two, because social is first. It's coming out in social first. Right. So, like, it's just more obvious on your stacking.
And it's more obvious because social is an instinct that sends energy and attention and conversation toward the other. You know, it's considering the other. And so sexual social, which is my stacking, and self-pres sexual, which is Jessica's stacking, we also are in this sort of contraflow that David talked about, but we're not as sort of, the content of our conversation is not as people focused. Does that make sense? Like, it's not as toward people broadly and categories and that kind of stuff.
But it's still just as separate.
Right, just as separate. Yeah. Anyways, all of this to say, I didn't have language to understand why David's concepts of, like, participatory versus non-participatory were valid. But we were seeing that in our data collection. We were seeing that they were valid, but we couldn't understand why. And so...
And non-participatory. Did I say that right?
Non-participatory. Yes, yes, yes. Anyways, that's okay.
But in referring to that, you're saying this zooming out kind of idea, or like brought, like, out of body experience kind of thing. So, like, the conscious flow stackings are all experiencing life in, not always, but, like, more naturally are going to experience things in an out-of-body experience, rather than what is the alternative to that?
So the Sinflow stackings, as he called them, were sexual self-pres, self-pres social, and social sexual. And we noticed in our data, those stackings wouldn't zoom out like this. They wouldn't leave their perspective to go watch it from, like, a sort of omniscient eye. And versus, like, the contraflow stackings, our stackings would sort of watch from an omniscient perspective.
What do they do? They just, like, live life?
They just, like, live life.
it's very much like, I feel this. They're just talking from their, like, one single perspective. I think this. I feel this. It's not like, well, generally humanity works like this. The quote contraflow stackings are almost teachy in this way, because you're zooming out and then you have to, like, communicate this outside perspective to people. It's not just like, well, I didn't like that, or I did like that.
Right. Now, so by outside perspective, are you meaning one, like, okay, I'm going to give you two examples. So, like, the example you used earlier that I had said, oh, do you ever experience a moment where you're thinking about how you might tell someone about the moment you're in later? And, like, that was what I was trying to explain to him. Like, sometimes I'll be in a moment, I'll be like, how would I explain how this moment exactly felt to someone else in the near future?
Not in your experience, it's so layered.
But what about someone who might be experiencing something and trying to think through that experience through various lenses of how it might affect this person or that person or that person? Is that also an out-of-body experience?
Because you're looking at them through other perspectives, which is also heady also, but there's like an inherent analytical nature to the contraflow stackings, where, like, you are, like, because you're looking at it from a various perspectives, like, there is, like, a... There is a viewing that doesn't happen from just your perspective.
So why is this, like, important to consider, or how is it relevant to, like, someone experiencing just normal life? Like, how does this help them know if they're contra or sinful?
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily helpful so much as it is fascinating. Like, this is a specific behavioral trend we've noticed. Like, I don't have specific advice for us because we're the three sort of... aerial Weirdos. View perspective.
Right.
Seconds. Yeah, it's like watching that one guy in the video who was like, one of the questions was like, if you had to put any moment of your life into a snow globe, what would you pick? And he was contraflow. And he was like, well, I just watched my brain do this. And that's a very, like, separate perspective. And I don't know how it helps. Maybe, like, if you have judgment about not being in the moment, then it would help with judgment. But
Right. I think this is more sort of just a behavioral trend we noticed in the language that people have in their interviews. But anyways, I want to return quickly to these concepts of sinflow and contraflow that David had, because we think they were so great and there's so much richness to them. David, if you ever listen, I think you're so cool. You have a lot of really wonderful concepts. But we wanted to slightly improve upon the concept as best as we could, because I wanted to have a reason behind why our contraflow stackings were viewing the world in this out-of-body aerial view. You know what I'm saying? It was an aerial perspective, and I didn't understand why. And I sort of stumbled upon this understanding. I think it started with sexual self-pres, because sexual self-pres is sort of the beginning of what David called the sinflow stackings. It represents sort of the beginning, the spark of life, the spark of creation. And so if you're not familiar with it, we've done podcasts on this before, but the sexual instinct, David correlated with fire and water. And so it represents both the instinct toward life and toward death. You know, that's why the sexual instinct is both hunter and prey. It is both the giver and the taker. It's two things at once. It is necessarily polar. And so I was really fascinated by this concept that David had, where he called the sexual instinct fire and water. He compared it to that, those two sort of elemental concepts. Well, at the same time, he compared the self-preservation instinct, which is grounded and static and reliable and safe, to earth. And he compared the social instinct to air, which is available and connected. And that's where the birds fly, and they have hierarchy, and they feel the wind, the implicit winds of the social world. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So I took David's concepts of self-preservation as earth and social as air, and I saw, well, social's above self-pres. There's an instinctual, like, natural hierarchy here. But then I was trying to figure out, where does the sexual instinct go? So if you want to read an article I wrote about this, it's on our site under the free learning section, notmytypeenneagram.com. Free learning. And I have an article that I wrote called The Instinctual Cycle, where I talk about this more in depth. But basically put, I realized there was a natural up and down nature. There was a vertical nature to self-preservation and social, and that social was always sort of above self-pres, not above in a better sense, but like it was a higher view than self-preservation. And I wanted to understand, why is it then that the sexual instinct is in two places? You know, if it's fire and water, where do those go?
Mm.
You know, in a sort of abstract image. And eventually we realized that because it is necessarily polar, the sexual instinct wasn't between these two instincts, but it was above and below at the same time.
Like the fire of like the earth, like inside the core. And
right.
Then you have the earth and you have the air. They need the fire of the celestial beings above.
Right, like the stars. And even think about like biblical imagery, like the idea of what's the sort of like overall like water,
the dome thing?
Right, there was this watery, we really should know this better, but like this like the waters above the sky, you know, the idea of,
yeah,
but you see this all throughout literature, this idea that like there is both fire and water above us too, above the air, which is so interesting. But this sort of like this necessarily polar dynamic of the sexual instinct made us realize that it was in two places at once, and the social and self-preservation instincts were between it. So we also have a visual for this in that article, if you want to look at it, where I sort of put some images together to sort of give you an elemental sense of how they interact. But sexual self-pres is at the very bottom of that cycle, where sexual is, if sexual is underneath the ground, underneath the self-pres ground, it moves upward into self-preservation.
Mm.
And that was sort of archetypally representative of like a seed opening. It was conception. It was birth. And this concept also is reflected in like a baby within the womb. You know, there's
right.
conception that happens.
And this is all representative of the sexual instinct.
Of not just the sexual instinct, but sexual moving into self-pres. Sexual self-pres as a stacking is symbolic of creation. Because
right.
it is moving upward. You know, it's starting at the underneath the ground and then moving upward toward the dirt. You know, so it has an upward motion, but it's still underground. So really, like, this baby being in the womb, it has an umbilical cord. It's still attached to mother. But there's no social other.
Mm.
So the social lines have no other people, really, in their world. Of course they do, but they're not really seeing the people. And sexual self-pres is seeing first its primary, like, romanticized other, the other it's intrinsically enmeshed with.
Mm.
And then there's sort of a self-preservation wall between that sort of romantic or enmeshed dynamic and the social world. You're going to see that thing.
No, that was it. Just the umbilical cord is a fantastic representation because they're literally, you are connected through the self-pres into, and like a baby, like when they first come out, they don't know the difference between mother and self. It's a very enmeshed thing.
Which
and
is
new. That's what sexual self-pres, it's just new. It's springing out of the ground,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And this is something that was we're talking very abstractly because this is a very abstract concept to discuss. But people who have sexual self-pres as their actual instinctual stacking have this sort of innocent, very baby-like quality.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if whoever is their sexual object of desire, like the person that they yearn for or that they're just honed in on, there's no social category. So for sexual self-pres, that sort of honed in on other is just an object of desire. You know, that's the sexual instinct. It has an other, it has a focused other, but it's like hunter-prey. There is one singular focus. But there's no social rule book or category in which that person is then contextualized or labeled. Sexual self-pres has this sort of lover archetype to it because it is just sort of infant and mother. Like, we're so connected that there's an actual cord between our bodies. And so that sort of infantile, really innocent, yet provocative and raw energy is very much there for sexual.
Yeah, and just like spilling out over itself because the sexual is there with all of like its flavor and what like it's using to provoke, and then it's coming out without kind of any social categories or social inhibitions through the self-pressed self. And so these individuals just like spill out, like when they're feeling emotions or when they're like in a certain state, like it's just spilling out. It feels like to me like a fountain bubbling over, and it's bubbling too much, and it's just like bubble, 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 and there's nothing there to stop it, and it just keeps going and going and going and going.
But the biggest thing is it's all underground. All of this energy is happening without the social rule book. That's really important. And so it has this bubbling over effect. It's moving upward, but it's very concentrated
and it's seeking.
Yeah, it's seeking. It's hunting. But it's so focused. And so David's concept of sin flow had this idea that the secondary instinct, quote unquote, supports the dominant. And we sort of liked this concept, but we wanted to tweak it just to suggest that for these first three stackings, the secondary instinct just reinforces the agenda of the dominant. So if the sexual instinct's agenda is to find a romanticized or arousing other to then pursue and hunt and become enmeshed with, the self-preservation instinct adds a wall between self and desired other, and then the whole rest of the world. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Like me, it's sort of like you and your lover in a cave, you know?
Right.
There's no one else there. And so the sexual instinct's merging quality is reinforced because there's no one there to distract.
Which is why it's vampiric.
Right. The sexual self-pressed stacking feels vampiric and very much...
it latches on, finds that other, and then it sustains it, and that's all there is.
Right. And the self-preservation instinct sustains. That's what it does. So it's sort of a sustaining of this sexual desire and attraction.
So David's theory is kind of outlying, even in a very vague, like, larger scale, how in a sin flow, which is the most natural, of what I'm understanding, the most natural way that instincts can flow, right?
That's what he argued.
Yeah. Sexual to self-pres, self-pres to social, that he also argues that whatever your secondary instinct is, so say that if I'm social self-pres, my secondary instinct is self-pres. Self-pres is helping. David's theory is, well, what is...
you're going somewhere with it, but that's okay. Basically, David suggested that the three contraflow stackings, our stackings, the secondary instinct defeated the dominant.
Okay, interesting.
So it was at odds with it.
Interesting.
So there's a lot more we could say about this, and we have talked about it before. But basically, he would say that sexual self-pres has this sort of natural addition of a self-preservation sustaining function to the sexual instinct's tunnel vision on one singular other.
Mm.
And there's no distraction, there's no social error to diffuse or blow away this fire. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot more we could say about this and that we want to say about this, but we have to end this episode. So we're going to come back and talk more about the other stackings and the terms that we sort of came to land on that we think fit a little bit better than quote-unquote sin flow and contra flow. So this concept that David had of the secondary instinct supporting the dominant in the sin flow stackings versus defeating the dominant in the contra flow stackings, we didn't love that concept because it, A, didn't make a lot of sense. Like, we didn't have any reason to believe in that.
Mm.
And secondarily, his flows had no explanation for why our stackings, the contra flow stackings, were doing this zooming out perspective. And what we realized is that this sort of upward motion begins at sexual self-pres and progresses through self-pres social into social sexual. And at that point, there's sort of an archetypal peak, a general gradual curve, which again, you can see in that article I illustrated. But we realized that at that point, it's not like it sort of returns back to sexual self-pres, but there's a turning that happens where suddenly the arc turns back downward and social sexual flows into sexual social. And then into social self-pres and self-pres sexual. And so we realized these two flows that David created, it didn't make sense for them to be oppositional to each other. They were rather part of one continual cycle. And that sexual self-pres, self-pres social, and social sexual were always moving upward and expanding in a basic way.
Mm.
And then sexual social, my stacking, social self-pres, Malia stacking, and self-pres sexual, Jessica stacking, were moving downward and sort of narrowing down and sort of representative of the closing death function. And so we realized this sort of life growth and maturation into sort of closing up shop and deterioration of the contra flow stackings. That was all part of one cycle, not two separate flows.
Which goes back to the whole tree metaphor that you mentioned in the beginning, which is the seed growing into a tree,
growing into
leaves, leaves dying, coming down to the ground.
Right. There's a lot we haven't gotten to yet with that concept. But I do want to say basically we came up with new terms for these concepts that David originally coined, which we think are just sort of more representative of this idea of one cycle as opposed to two. And so we've called what he called the sin flow stackings, we've labeled them waxing, like the moon sort of expanding and getting brighter. And so the waxing phases of the moon are representative of this growth of light. And then the waning stackings are the other three instincts as they sort of shrink and close up shop and get darker.
Yes. It's so good. It's so good because, like, David Gray, I love you, but the two, like, sin flow and contra, like, that were separate and honestly kind of negative for the contra flow stackings because it was like they were working backward. Now it fits with all of nature. You throw a ball up, it peaks, it comes to an apex, then it comes back down. Like, things grow and then they shrink. And this is in all of nature. It's not a separate growth cycle and a separate decay cycle. What grows, then decays, and then grows again. And so it just, like, uniformly not only fits, like, humanity, but, like, all of everything. It's gorgeous.
Right. So this sort of image of growth and maturation and then death and destruction, which is pretty violent language, but we'll view it more neutrally in the next episode where we're going to sort of break down the stackings a little bit more thoroughly. But thanks for listening, guys. I hope you enjoyed it. Come check out our website at notmytypeenneagram.com. You can find us on TikTok, on Facebook, on Instagram. Just search Not My Type Enneagram. We have a lot of great content. I hope you enjoyed this episode.
Bye.
Bye.